We seek a strong finish to our current fiscal year. Call 217-244-9455 or go to willpledge.org to make your gift today. And thanks.
This is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin. My thanks to my colleague, Audie Cornish, for filling in for me while I was away last week. We'd like to start today by going back to what many people, including President Obama, are calling a crisis at the U.S.-Mexico border. There, thousands of undocumented and unaccompanied children are being held in detention centers. The Border Patrol estimates that 52,000 unaccompanied children, mostly from Central America, have been apprehended trying to cross the border just since October. The problem has become so serious that on Friday, Vice President Joe Biden met with Central American leaders in Guatemala to talk about the issues that are said to be driving this surge across the border. We wanted to know more about that, so we've called Alan Gomez. He covers immigration for USA Today. Welcome, Alan. Thanks for joining us.
Great to be here.
And we wanted to hear more about the conditions at these detention centers, which have become very difficult for the children, as well as the people working there. So we called Chris Sherman for more on that. He is a reporter for the Associated Press who visited a detention center in Brownsville, Arizona. Chris, welcome to you as well. Thanks for coming.
Hi, Michelle. Thanks for having me.
Well, Alan, I'm going to start with you because you kept track of the vice president's visit. Have we learned anything new about what's driving these children across the border?
Well, as with any immigration debate here in Washington, there's some disagreement as to what exactly is leading them here. There's a lot of folks in D.C. right now who are saying that it's due to the president's lax immigration record, that he's put up the welcome mat to undocumented immigrants to come here, that they'll be allowed to stay here if they get here. But the more you look at what's going on in Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador, the three countries where the vast majority of these kids are coming from, it is just staggering the levels of violence and the terrible condition that the economy is in those three countries. And that's what at least a lot of the kids that are coming over here are saying is the reason that they're coming. Honduras, El Salvador, Guatemala, three of the top six murder rates in the world right now. Drug cartels are running rampant down there. Gangs are just getting out of hand. And so a lot of, as we're seeing more of these reporters getting down there, more people talking to these parents who are doing that the unthinkable of sending their kid off on this just incredibly dangerous journey, a lot of them are pointing to the fact that they're just incredibly worried about their kids and what's going to happen to them if they stay in these incredibly violent countries.
Yeah, the kid, just briefly on the point that you made that some people in Washington are thinking that it's the president's lax immigration policies. Are there rumors that, or is there in fact misinformation about what the policies are?
Oh, absolutely. And this has been from this stems back a couple of years now. The president, if you remember, a few years ago created a program called Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. And what that does is allow a young undocumented or an undocumented immigrant who was brought here when they were young to apply to the federal government and get a sort of deportation reprieve for a couple of years. The thing is, there is a cutoff date for that. And that cutoff date was many years ago. And a lot of people in Central America are saying that idea of the cutoff date didn't quite filter all the way down. Mm. Even now, as we see Congress still trying to pass some version of immigration reform, anybody who would qualify for any kind of path to citizenship within that bill, there's another cutoff date for that, and that's also a few years ago. So any of these kids that are getting here now do not benefit from any of these, either Obama's program to allow some of them to stay or any sort of congressional bill that's being considered. But some of them do think that once they get here that they might qualify for something like that. So it's been really difficult. I can tell you Vice President Biden, when he was down there, that was one of the main objectives of going there, was to speak directly to the people of those three countries to let them know that they will not qualify for any of those. That once the kids do get here, yes, we're going to take care of them. Yes, we're going to house them, but they're also going to immediately be put into deportation proceedings.
Well, speaking of those kids who are already here, Chris, you visited a detention center. Just give us some of your impressions, some of the things that we've seen. A lot of people have been seeing, images of these detention centers, and they don't look like the kinds of places most of us would want our children. You know, kids packed very closely together, very little in the way of amenities. Tell us what you saw.
Of course. I visited the Fort Brown Border Patrol Station in Brownsville, Texas. This has been the hub where the children arrested here in the Rio Grande Valley, and this is the southernmost tip of Texas. This is where about three-quarters of all the children who have been arrested, unaccompanied children, have been arrested here on the southwest border. And at the Fort Brown Station, It's just a Border Patrol station. They have eight holding cells inside. They are probably what you would expect for something called a holding cell: concrete walls, concrete floor, concrete bench, single toilet back in the corner, glass window in front. And the problem is that with so many children, they're having difficulty processing them quickly enough and moving them on. The law requires that the Border Patrol transfer custody of these unaccompanied children to the Health and Human Services Department within 72 hours of their arrest. And that's basically just recognition that these Border Patrol stations are ill-equipped to hold anyone, much less children, for a long period of time.
Can I ask you this? And if we can, just for a moment, set aside the politics of why these children are here or whatever information led them to come here. How are the agents dealing with this? I'm imagining that many of them have children themselves. And I'm just wondering, but they weren't trained, I don't think, necessarily to handle, you know, young children. How are they coping with that?
It's extremely difficult, and on this tour, we were not permitted to speak with any of the agents, and it was very quick. But prior to that, in the weeks prior, I've been hearing from Border Patrol agents who contact me to let me know how difficult the conditions are. You're absolutely right. They have children, too, and I can only imagine the impact that it must be to deal with these kids in this situation on a day-to-day basis, because we had 10 minutes in and out of that Border Patrol station on the tour. And, you know, even though I'd interviewed these agents prior, I'd seen some of the leaked photos, it's still a bit different when, you know, the kids behind the glass are waving at you.
How do the kids seem, by the way? Do they seem scared? Do they seem relieved? Are they hungry? How do they seem?
It's a mix. Again, we weren't allowed to interview any of the children when we took that tour. So you try to make eye contact with as many as you can, and some of them are smiling and waving and trying to get your attention. Others are have more a blank expression. Some others we saw there and you saw in the photos were, you know, sleeping under blankets on the floor, kind of in a big pile. I think it's safe to assume, though, that most are scared. I've interviewed kids, you know, before they go into these stations and after they've been through the process, and they say that they have no idea really what to expect. Sure, there are rumors that they've heard that you'll be treated all right and you'll eventually be reunited with your family if you have parents in the U.S., but they really, you drill down deeper and they really have no idea what's about to happen.
I'm speaking with Chris Sherman of the Associated Press and Alan Gomez of USA Today, and we're talking again about the thousands of undocumented minors who are being held in detention facilities across the U.S.-Mexico border, many of them crossing from Central America trying to get to the U.S. So Alan, what are some of the things that, you know, you said that Vice President Joe Biden talked about the situation. In part, he wanted to send the message that, you know, if you've been hearing that there's an amnesty, you'll be able to say that that's wrong. Anything else? Were there any other objectives or goals for the visit, and were any of those accomplished?
Yeah, I mean, this is the problem with an issue as big as it's become. They're working on two things, sort of short term and long term. On the short term, they're trying to work with the governments down there to see what they can do to sort of try to stop this flow as quickly as they can. It's, as you can imagine, that's incredibly hard. These are countries, because of the raging violence down there, they don't exactly have a lot of money to suddenly invest in these in border patrol and to sort of lock down their border. So they got their hands pretty full as it is. But the other thing they're trying to do is kind of address some of these long-term issues as well. While the vice president was down there, he announced a $40 million grant for Guatemala, $25 million grant for El Salvador, and $18 million grant for Honduras. And all of those are directed at kind of crime prevention, community policing, gang violence mitigation. I mean, trying to get at these root issues. That is what's behind the decision of so many of these parents to send their kids. And so, as you can imagine, it's kind of hard to suddenly make Honduras a safe place to be. That's something that's going to take years, if not decades, to do. And so in the immediate short term, what they're doing is just trying to get them to keep them there as much as they can. And then, you know, obviously here stateside, as Chris is seeing down there, they're trying to get a lot of these kids to other facilities further from the border, facilities that are better equipped to take care of children. And that's become a completely different headache for the administration, as they've tried to identify facilities around the country that can accommodate these children and care for them, both just from a moral standpoint, but also just legally. There are certain requirements that the government has to meet when they're taking care of these kids. And because of the flood, they're looking everywhere, from Virginia to Baltimore to Illinois. Down here in Miami, they've sent some kids down here. So they're really kind of working on this on several different levels.
Chris, we have about a minute left. Tell us what else you know about what exactly are they trying to do with those facilities there. Are they trying to adapt those facilities, or are they really just trying to move people out as quickly as possible?
Yes, in the case of the Fort Brown facility, they've absolutely tried to adapt it for the children they have there. They have about 500 kids there on any given day. They've brought in assistance from FEMA, so now the kids get taken outside in groups for showers in a shower trailer. They get about half an hour of exercise, which is, you know, kicking around a ball, throwing a ball in a side yard. The younger kids get to do some coloring. But otherwise, they're spending, you know, about 23 hours a day inside these holding cells until they can be transferred to the Health and Human Services Department, which puts them in a shelter atmosphere, which is, you know, much better prepared and equipped to deal with children over a longer period.
That was Chris Sherman from the Associated Press. We reached him at his office in McAllen, Texas. Also with us, Alan Gomez. He reports on immigration for USA Today, and he was kind enough to join us from member station WLRN in Miami. Thank you both so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, after years of legal wrangling, a $40 million settlement has been reached in the case of the so-called Central Park Five. They are the young men who were wrongfully accused and convicted back in 1990 of a vicious rape and beating that left a jogger in Central Park close to death. We'll hear more about the settlement, and we will remember why the case rocked New York City decades ago and remains controversial today. That's ahead on Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. Meet James Ward. His family was homeless and he crowdfunded his way to college. Now he has advice for other homeless teens.
Stay strong and ambitious and determined, because there's 1,000 reasons why you shouldn't succeed in life, but all you need is one to get to where you need to be.
That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
Weekdays starting at noon on AM 580.
WILL programming is made possible by Hendrick House, providing housing and food service to University of Illinois students for 66 years. The Hendrick House Dining Facility, with Gold LEED certification, grows produce on its green roof and in its farm plot and supports local farmers. More information is available at hendrickhouse.com.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Now we turn to the latest chapter in a crime story that riveted and divided New York City more than 20 years ago. We are talking about the Central Park Five. That's the name that was attached to the group of Black and Latino teenagers who were convicted, wrongly it turns out, of raping and beating a female jogger in the park back in 1989. Eventually, another man confessed to the crime, but that only came after the young man had spent years in prison. In 2012, we spoke with one of the Central Park Five, Raymond Santana, about the lawsuit that the group filed against the city, and this is what he had to say.
Now the civil suit is going into its 10th year, and currently we're in the deposition stages. which means that we still have some ways to go. And what happened is that because the city likes to use these stall tactics, and they have been implementing these tactics for the past 9 years now, and so it's currently at a standstill.
Well, the standstill ended last week when the city reached a $40 million settlement with the group. Here to talk to us about that and the case in general is Sarah Byrne. She's the author of The Central Park Five, the untold story behind one of New York City's most infamous crimes. She's also co-producer of the Central Park Five documentary. Welcome back to the program, Sarah. Thanks for joining us once again.
Thanks for having me.
Do we know why this, after all this time, a settlement finally came together? What do you think were the critical factors?
I think it was a new administration that made all the difference. The entire 10 years, first 10 years of this case was under the Bloomberg administration, and I don't think there was any pressure on the city's law department to settle this case. In fact, it seems like their intention was to drag it out as long as possible. But during the mayoral campaign last year, Bill de Blasio, who ultimately became the mayor, commented on it during the campaign, saying that he thought that there was a moral imperative to settle this case. And so there was, once he won, an obligation, I think, to come in and actually address this. And so from early on, you know, he appointed a new corporation counsel for the city, and they began talking about settlements, I think, pretty much as soon as he came in. They were going to address two things, this case and stop and frisk. And they settled both of those lawsuits now within the first half a year.
Yeah, obviously this is a complicated case, which is why you wrote a book about it and also produced a documentary about it, because there are many elements to it. But as briefly as you can, from the beginning, there was little physical evidence to connect these young men to the crime. So what led to their convictions?
Right. There was no physical evidence connecting them, but they were coerced into giving statements that implicated themselves. They all thought they were going to be witnesses, you know, and implicate other people whom they often didn't even know. And so, you know, they were 14, 15, and 16 years old, and I think very vulnerable to these seasoned detectives who interrogated them. And the problem is that everyone jumped to conclusions too quickly. The detectives, these kids had been in the park, part of a larger group who had harassed and assaulted some people, and so they were obvious suspects. But then it just snowballs, and once everyone's decided they're guilty, the real facts, once the evidence comes back, the negative DNA tests don't change anyone's mind. And by then, it's already a huge, sensational media story.
Why do you tell us again about why this became such a sensational story? I mean, obviously, you know, one's heart goes out to this young woman who was, you know, grievously wounded and attacked and had suffered years of, you know, recovery as a consequence of it. But what do you think about this so gripped the city?
Yeah, I think there were a lot of factors. I mean, as you said, the crime itself was a brutal, horrific crime. The fact that she survived at all was really miraculous. She was in a coma for several weeks and had no memory, of course, of the attack. But it was that it had happened in Central Park, which is, you know, even though at the time that was the butt of jokes about crime, nonetheless, a safe part of the city and a place that people thought of as a, you know, a place to get away, this idyllic setting. And then there were these race and class issues. You have the accused are these young Black and Latino teenagers from East Harlem. You have a victim who is a white woman who is an investment banker. And it's this sort of clash of all of these things that are going on in the city that really made it perfect fodder for the tabloids.
What happened now that the fact is this, that the person who a person did claim responsibility for this. Unfortunately, this happened after, as I understand and as I recall, most of the young men had served most of their sentences. But he did claim responsibility. It turned out he had a lengthy record of violence that did include sexual assault. It's my understanding that to this day, there are some people who do not believe these young men are innocent. Why is that?
Well,
any idea?
Yes, that's true. You know, mostly the people who say that have some stake, I think, in that initial verdict. So you hear it from people who were involved in that original case, for whom admitting that they're innocent would mean accepting that they had failed, that they had gotten this wrong, had made a mistake, and that they're responsible for that. And so I think that's certainly a factor. And I think part of it is the sort of lingering racism that you see, that we saw in this case initially, which is that it was far too easy for people to believe that these kids were guilty in the first place, I think because of who they were and what they looked like and where they came from. And I think that there's a kind of lingering sense of that now where it's, hard to believe that they're innocent, even when the facts point in that direction.
What are they going to do now? What are their lives now? How have they been living these past couple of years?
Yeah, I mean, you know, things have certainly been different for them since the convictions were vacated in 2002. That made it easier for them to get jobs. They're no longer registered sex offenders and don't have to, you know, put down their convictions on a job application. But that doesn't mean that life has been easy for them, certainly. I think they've all adjusted in their own ways and have had varying degrees of success. You know, they're working and some have families and stuff like that. But I think that having a settlement in the case, not just about the amount of money and what that does for their lives, but really the fact of the hopefully some closure for them and maybe the ability to move on and try to put this behind them to the extent that that's possible is really the significant thing.
Has the city put that behind it? Has anything changed as a result of all that went on then?
You know, I think that New York City is in some ways a very different place than it was in 1989. Certainly crime rates are a fraction of what they were then, and so some of the accompanying fear of crime has also diminished. But I think that we still see a lot of the same racism that led to, I think, the reaction to this case in the first place. I mean, we've been talking a lot about stop and frisk in the last couple of years here, and I think that that reflects a similar suspicion of Black and Latino teenagers that we saw back then. So In some ways, not much has changed, and I don't think we've really learned the lessons of this case yet. I think we are more aware of false confessions and wrongful convictions thanks to all the exonerations that have taken place in the last 20 years that seem to be speeding up all the time. But, you know, I think we still make some of these same assumptions, and so we're still working on that.
What has been the response to the settlement? I understand that certain high-profile figures, for example, Donald Trump has been critical of it. What has been the reaction to the settlement so far? It's very new information, but what are you hearing?
Sure, and it's not even, I think, I mean, this isn't even official news. We don't actually know. It's not confirmed yet, but it certainly seems like that's where things are headed, is towards this settlement. Why we're even asking Donald Trump what he thinks about this, mm-hmm. I'm not sure. But, you know, for the most part, I think the response has been very positive. Everything that I've read, or just about everything, has been, you know, we know that these guys are innocent and that it's been a very, you know, it's been 25 years since we got this wrong, and it's now time to finally try to make it right a little bit. So that's mainly been the response. I mean, I think other than people who, again, as I said, are invested in that original outcome, I think people are now coming to understand what really happened in this story.
Very briefly, Sarah, if you don't mind my asking, as very briefly if you can, you've invested a lot of your own time in reporting on this story. I was just wondering why it captivates you so much.
Yeah, you know, I have. It's been over a decade now. I first wrote about it as an undergraduate. It was my senior essay in college, and then I kind of couldn't let go of it. You know, it seemed like such an important story, and at the time, one that really hadn't been told. I think that people knew the story of the wilding in Central Park and the Central Park jogger rape and these kids who'd been convicted. And when they were turned out they were innocent, that wasn't the story.
Okay.
And that bothered me.
Sarah Burns is the author of The Central Park Five, and she's co-producer of the documentary of the same name. And we reached her at her home office in New York City. Sarah Burns, thanks for speaking with us.
Thanks for having me.
We're switching gears now and returning to tennis. Wimbledon starts today in London. It's the sport's oldest Grand Slam tournament. All eyes are on Serena Williams, a five-time Wimbledon champ, but she had a disappointing performance at the French Open weeks ago, leaving many to wonder if she's got what it takes to win again. And then there are the up-and-comers who are creating buzz and bringing yet more diversity to tennis. We wanted to hear more about this year's Wimbledon on and off the court, so we've called Courtney Newen. She runs the Beyond the Baseline tennis blog for Sports Illustrated, and she's with us now from London. Courtney, thanks so much for speaking with us. Welcome.
Thank you very much. Lovely to be speaking with you.
So the big buzz is still around Serena Williams. What are people saying?
Well, I mean, there are a lot of questions about Serena as she comes into this tournament. And as you said, you know, she's coming off a really bad loss at the French Open. It was her worst Grand Slam loss of her entire career, a long storied career. So I think that's where we kind of were like, that's not good. And she's been a bit tense in the way that she's kind of been dealing with press and has come into this tournament as pretty much the overwhelming favorite simply because she's so good on this surface.
So why didn't she open the women's tournament on center court? As I understand it, that honor usually goes to the previous year's winner, but that is Marion Bartoli, but she's retired, so a lot of people thought it would go to Serena Williams. Do you think she was snubbed?
I do think that she was snubbed. The All England Club has basically three criteria that they look at in a situation like this. Either they go with the top seed, which is Serena Williams. They go with the, you know, other defending champion, which would be Serena Williams, who won it in 2012. Or they go with the finalist of last year's final, which is a German, Sabina Lisicki. And they decided to go with Lisicki. Lisicki really had a very charming tournament last year. The British public loved her. She beat Serena. And to Serena's credit, she didn't make a big deal out of it. But I just really think, you know, the typical tradition is that a champion opens the tournament, mm-hmm. and Sabina Lisicki is not a champion.
So why do you think that they went with her?
Well, I think that, the Brits do love her, and she's really charmed them over the course of her performances here at Wimbledon, which is by far Lisicki's best tournament of any tournament. And, you know, I mean, I think that in Britain, there is kind of a love-hate relationship with Serena Williams, with Venus Williams. This isn't the first time that we've seen them kind of get a questionable court assignment, where sometimes they're kind of stuck out playing on number three court or number two court, depending on things. And so they've never really embraced Serena as a champion.
What's
here.
Up with that? She's just not their cup of tea?
She's just not their cup of tea. You know, I mean, I think that, you know, is there a racial component to it? I wouldn't go as far as to say that, but she's just not the elegant, you know, a Barbie doll champion that they want. And this tournament has never shied away from that. And they've admitted in the past saying, yes, we actually do kind of use aesthetics and a woman's looks in terms of how we schedule our court placements and who plays where. And, you know,
and
I think
aesthetics
they got,
meaning what, according to...
Well,
that's a complicated topic, isn't
exactly.
it?
Exactly. Yeah, it is. It's a very complicated topic, and it's a topic that comes up quite a bit when we talk about, you know, Serena Williams. There's another young American player, Taylor Townsend, who got into a bit of a... There was a whole thing with her a couple years ago with the USTA and about how she looked, and they thought that she was overweight and not fit enough, but she was actually posting great results, and so you have this kind of disconnect there. But with Serena, you know, I mean, this tournament, they like their Maria Sharapovas. They like their Anna Kournikovas. And, you know, the choice of Lisicki wasn't entirely surprising.
Mm. So speaking about Taylor Townsend, is she one to watch?
She definitely is one to watch. She is one of those players that gets us in the writer's room, a very cynical tennis writing room, very excited about the future of the game. She's, you know, very young, just, 18 years old and former junior number one, has won junior slams, left-handed player. And what is exciting about her is not just her game, but just her mentality. She's just got a great personality. She's had to go through a lot of adversity of people really publicly criticizing her weight and her fitness. And she's really, I mean, for a teenager to have to deal with that in the public eye, for her to come out of it so strong and so positive is really incredible.
And she's also African-American. Point.
She is African-American. Yeah, she's from Chicago, splits her time with in Washington, D.C. as well.
Sensing a theme here about, you know, it's interesting that Wimbledon is competing with World Cup. I mean, a lot of the world's eyes are on World Cup this week, and we're seeing an array of people from across the world, you know, competing and enjoying that. Sometimes, you know, it's been declared an anti-racism tournament that the president of Brazil has made a big point of saying that we want to show the world that we can put on an international tournament where people are appreciated, you know, no matter
right.
who they are. And I just wonder if a similar message is going out at Wimbledon or perhaps not.
Yeah, I mean, this has always been the slowest tournament to adopt progressive measures. For example, equal prize money is another thing. This was the last tournament to do it, and it took a very forceful letter from Venus Williams, who really championed it, to get the club to finally accept, okay, yeah, we should pay the guys or the girls the same as we pay the guys. And it was just a completely arbitrary decision that they made to in terms of the unequal pay scale from before. So it's... kind of just what Wimbledon is. I mean, as much as people talk about, oh, tradition and all these things as a positive, there are also negatives to it. And, you know, in terms of, I mean, tennis for us, our World Cup is every, you know, few months. I mean, our four slams are incredibly international, and the game has grown all over the globe so that it isn't one that's dominated just by America, Australia, France, and the UK.
But before we let you go, Courtney, any other players that you're excited to see? And we've been kind of focusing on the women, so maybe somebody on the men's side, speaking of diversity, anybody on the men's side that we should keep an eye on as well?
Well, of course. Well, on the men's side, you know, there's a kind of a whole slew of young players moving up. But I think that the three ones that everyone's kind of keeping an eye on is we finally have a Canadian man who's actually quite good, Milos Raonic. There's another Japanese player, Kei Nishikori, so getting kind of the Asian market involved. And then there's Grigor Dimitrov, who's Bulgarian, Maria Sharapova's boyfriend. He gets a lot of headlines for that. But he's playing incredible tennis and, you know, has a shot for a very deep run here at Wimbledon.
Courtney Nguyen blogs at Beyond the Baseline for Sports Illustrated, and she was kind enough to take a little time out from Wimbledon, where she's covering the tournament, to speak with us. Courtney, thanks so much. Enjoy the matches.
Thank you very much.
Coming up, South African legend Hugh Masekela says when he was a kid, he was always in trouble until he found music.
I said, if I can get a trumpet, Father, I won't bother anybody anymore. So he got me a trumpet and a trumpet teacher.
We'll hear about how that trumpet changed his life and the lives of music lovers around the world. That's just ahead on Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the Walton Family Foundation, whose K-12 initiative works to empower families with quality school choices. WaltonK12.org. From the estate of Miles Gatterman, whose bequest is an appreciation of public radio and its commitment to introducing music to all walks of life. From Cigna, a global health service company dedicated to helping people improve their health, well-being, and sense of security at Cigna.com. And from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR.
2014 marks the 50th anniversary of Freedom Summer, in which hundreds of mostly white student volunteers from colleges across the country spent weeks registering African Americans to vote in Mississippi. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Stanley Nelson, the director of a new documentary about Freedom Summer, and Charles Cobb, who helped organize the event. Join us.
Weekdays at 11 a.m. and 7 p.m. on AM 580.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Owens Funeral Home, located at the corner of Elm and University in the historic Trevett Mansion, across from Westside Park in downtown Champaign. Owens Funeral Home, owned and operated by the Owens family since 1925, invites you to join them in supporting public radio.
Hi, I'm Diane Noland, host of Mid-American Gardener on WILL-TV. Join me and my panel of experts each week as we discuss lawn and gardening care tailored to Zone 5 growing conditions. We'll also answer your gardening questions, so call in during the show or send an email for us to answer on the air. Join me for Mid-American Gardener Thursday nights at 7 on WILL-TV or listen Saturday mornings at 6:30 on AM 580.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. It's summer, and for a lot of people, that means music. It's a time when many people take advantage of the many festivals going on around the country to discover new artists or reconnect with old favorites. And in that spirit, we thought we'd bring you an encore of our conversation with Hugh Masekela. He's one of Africa's best-known musicians. He is an international star with a career that spanned decades. His 1968 breakout hit, Grazing in the Grass, was number one on the American pop charts and a worldwide hit. Masekela's impact is really hard to describe in few words. He's released some 40 albums, appeared on too many to count. He's appeared with artists as wide-ranging as Herb Albert, The Byrds, Paul Simon, Fela Kuti, and the late, great Miriam Makeba, to whom he was once married. Now in his 70s, Masekela is still touring, which is how we caught up with him last spring when he stopped by our studios in Washington, D.C. And I started by asking him how he fell in love with music.
I got possessed by music as an infant. So by the time I started playing the trumpet, I was already a bona fide musician. And I was playing classical music as well as other things. And I had a beautiful high tenor voice, you know, like those British boys in the cathedral. Oh, yeah.
I see.
Yeah, so I asked for that from my chaplain at school. I was always in trouble with the authorities because my attention span was completely off because all I heard was music. So when I looked at the teachers, their mouths were just moving. And I was singing all Charlie Parker and Thelonious Monk and Bud Powell and, you know, the new bebop players had just emerged and we were mesmerized by them. And so, like, that's what I was hearing. And whenever my name was called, I ended up at the principal's office because I didn't know the question.
But yeah, also, so, you just had trouble with authority, period. I mean, right, that's fair to say.
Not really. I was a good boy, you know. My mother thought, oh, what a good boy. although, I mean, as a kid, I was punished. I was whipped on a slow day at least 3 times. It was a priest that said, what do you want to do with your life? I said, if I can get a trumpet, Father, I won't bother anybody anymore. So he got me a trumpet and a trumpet teacher.
It came to pass that you first, I think you went to London first, and then you came to New York.
Yeah.
And you were there at such an amazing time. I mean, people like Dizzy Gillespie kind of took you under their wing, right?
No, well, I was lucky, you know? Because I was brought to the stage by Miriam Makeba, who was an ex girlfriend of mine and a dear friend, and we'd always dreamt of coming to the States, but she came a year earlier and blew the States away. She was on first name basis with everybody. Then she and Harry Belafonte gave me a scholarship to Manhattan School of Music. I also had to work part-time in Harry Belafonte's music publishing, because I ain't gonna give you no money. You gotta work for your money. You're never paying your school fees. Gonna get you a cheap place to stay, and you gotta work, man. You know, and all these people were their friends.
I was gonna ask if you can describe what those years were like for you. I mean, on the one hand, you must have been terribly homesick.
The first time I dreamt in English, I realized, that I might never go home because by then, Miriam Makeba and Harry Belafonte were already banned, you know, and they were sending me to school. I think that the things that were most difficult for me were the cold.
The cold?
Yeah, the snow, and I mean, that really made me homesick. I remember that my first snow, I wrote to my mother right away, and I took a picture in the snow, and I said, I'm not smiling, I'm grimacing from the cold. It is really cold here.
Were you sad during that time? Was it hard, or was it so
exciting? Because it was a great time for me. I mean, I was exposed to like the greatest music. It was the greatest time in music in the States, I think, you know, the 1960s. And I was really fascinated by what I was doing. I felt like I'd come to the right place at the right time. But, you know, when you're a student and you're in a foreign country, you miss your relatives most. You know, especially when I was hungry, I was like, damn, Saturday afternoon, I just could have gone to my aunt's place and, like, make that tripe stew, you know, with the hominy grits. And I'm talking to myself, you know. So one day I was talking to myself in the park on a Sunday afternoon, and I had a tap on my shoulder, and this cop said, "Excuse me, buddy. You know, see those folks over there? So yeah, they say they've been looking at you for 2 hours. You've been talking to yourself. Are you okay?" Then I explained to him what I was going through. He went, okay, now I know what that must feel like. And he knew everything about South Africa and those bastards. And,
he knew all about South Africa?
And we became friends for many years.
Really?
Because he was a young policeman. I mean, I was much younger. That's how homesick you can be. But I was surrounded by so much beauty and so much generosity and so much joy. And it was a new world. It was the world that I wanted to live in when I heard records when I was a small kid. I thought that the people lived in the gramophone, you know, in the Victrola. And I wanted to get in there and go and come and live with them. And now here I was living with them. I mean, it was... couldn't ask for anything more.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with musical giant Hugh Masekela. You know, people these days often think of artists as either, you know, popular or as political. But when you came up, there was not a difference between the two. People were very interested in politics who were also very popular. And one of your song, Bring Him Back Home, about Nelson Mandela, it became an anti-apartheid anthem in the late 1980s. I just want to play a little bit.
I don't know in other countries, but like when I grew up, you were not political. You were bombarded by politics. So like we grew up in protests, rallies and boycott marches. And from time to time, there'd be shootings and you'd watch people getting killed. And we're not naive and we're not like, wow, there's a thing called politics. Yeah. We're under its boot. And we wanted to get out of there, and that's how we grew up. Mandela was the symbol. It was the voice of all those people. There were a whole gang of them, like Oliver Tambo and Walter Sisulu, and like all those people who came and brought us the direction to get out of our chains.
Yeah.
They did their job, and they're a hard act to follow. The greatest thing is that they did for us was they said, like, never again will one group of people get to dominate another. You know, and we must try and forgive those who oppressed us and, like, build our country with them and teach them the gift of love and forgiveness.
Well, speaking, though, of being free from chains, one of the things that was, I don't know why I didn't know this. I read this in your book, how just deeply involved you were with every drug there was. I mean, alcohol, cocaine, you were really explicit. Well, how are you now, by the way? All good?
Well,
you're good?
What you see is what you get.
I hear you. Why?
I mean, how do I look for
you look
a 74-year-old
well,
guy?
Well, you look pretty great. You know, controversial now, giving compliments about people's appearance.
How sexist can you be?
I know, I'm sorry. Apologize. But you opened the door, so. That do you have any thoughts about why? Was that just the way it was at the time?
When I grew up, liquor was illegal for African people in South Africa. It only was legalized. I was here a year when it was legalized in South Africa.
Wow.
There were speakeasies all over. I mean, every fifth house in the townships or rural areas was a speakeasy. And my grandmother had a speakeasy, and they were called shebeens. And I was born in my grandmother's shebeen. And drunkenness, to a great extent, was a form of defiance, you know. And there were people who were famous for being great drinkers. There were people, when they entered the room, people would take off their hats, said, "This man can drink." There was that prestige. I started drinking when I was 13 years old, but I started drinking out of, like, peer pressure because I had the most beautiful voice. And they were beginning to look at girls, and my friends said, "Man, we can't hang out with you anymore because we're beginning to look at the babes. And here you are singing in their range, you know. It puts a little damper on us, you know. So we So finally I said, what should I do? They said, well, you have to drink and smoke so like your voice can get messed up. Hmm. And then you can sing bass. And I worked on that. And a year later, I was singing bass. My voice was destroyed. And the girls were not impressed.
How old were you when you finally got sober? How old were you? I forget now. You were
58.
58.
Yeah. I didn't get sober. I stopped killing myself. There's a difference, you know, like the thing that you shouldn't stop enjoying life. But you just have to stop beating yourself up and other people and hanging out with people who are beating themselves up.
What has kept your music so fresh and exciting? What has kept you so continuing to work?
If music was the devil, I would need an exorcist. That's how, you know, obsessed and possessed I am with it, and that I've always been like that. And I think, like, when you're not tunnel-visioned, you become a better person. You understand humanity much more. And music is a gateway to the world, you know. So I think that what I do is always fresh because I'm always, like, I'm fascinated by everything.
I can't let you go without asking about Miriam Makeba because you are such a, you're both so brilliant. But just hearing about your relationship, it just sounds like it's just like such a nightmare on one hand. On the other hand, so I don't even know what to make of it, really.
Our personal relationship was like not even hills, mountains and valleys. But Miriam Makeba was the epitome, the very portrait of what Africa was about. You know, her grandmother and her great-grandmother and her mother were all traditional healers. Miriam Makeba helped everybody she could have a chance to help, regardless of who they were. And she helped every liberation movement in Africa and outside Africa, the civil rights movements in South America. And she would take her last clothes and give them to students or, like, buy medicine for refugee camps. And she just was the most generous person I have ever known, you know. And
but your personal relationship just sounds like a nightmare.
Well, it wasn't a nightmare for us, no. You know. It might look like a nightmare, but it was. When you grow up in the township, and what me and Miriam went through overseas is very light stuff compared to, like, what happens even in the ghetto, you know, where, like, there's even killings, you know. Because people out there are pretty loose.
You have had such an amazing life. You've seen so many things. You've been part of so many musical movements. I don't even know where to start. But do you have some advice for someone who loves music as you do?
Well, I think that the best advice you can give anybody is that if they love something and they want to be involved with it, the first thing they have to do is to be honest with themselves. How much do they like this thing? Do they have a passion for it? And second, they have to be like honest about, have they been told that they seem to be very talented in this field? Because whatever you go into, you have to go in there to be the best. There's no formulas. It's all about passion and honesty and hard work. It might look glamorous, but it takes a lot of hard work. The blessing with the arts is that you can do it forever, until you drop dead. That's the blessing. But I'm 74 and I feel that I'm just beginning, so I think I'm very fortunate to have been, like, bedeviled by music.
Musical legend Hugh Masekela spoke with us during his U.S. tour last spring. For more about his life and career, please go to our website. That's the Tell Me More page of NPR.org. And finally today, it's time for the regular feature we call In Your Ear. That's where we invite some of our guests to tell us about the top songs on their playlist. Actress Anika Noni Rose is both on Broadway and on the big screen right now. She's currently starring in Half of a Yellow Sun, which was filmed in Nigeria and South Africa. And she's one of the stars of the Tony-winning Broadway revival of A Raisin in the Sun. When we caught up with her recently, she also talked about the music that lifts her spirits.
Hi, I'm Anika Noni Rose, and here's what's playing in my ear.
I'm waking up to ash and dust. I wipe my brow and I sweat my rust. I'm breathing in the chemicals.
I am listening to Imagine Dragons, Radioactive with Kendrick Lamar. I love it because it's hype. And when you're getting ready to do your workout, If you're on that treadmill, if you need a song to get you moving, I promise this is the one, and Kendrick Lamar is ridiculous on a song. Tell me you love me, tell me that I don't give a f- can barely decide. Wish you could let go my enemies, all of my energy go to the almighty. Can I get drowning about it? What Hennessy, f- you amenities, I'm getting better with time. I'm waking up. Odyssey has a new album out, which is pretty phenomenal. People keep asking about this glow I seem to have, cause I'm just not the same. They say I'm walking different, talking different. It's like all of me has changed. What a lot of people don't know about Odyssey is that she is an amazing jazz singer, and she's had this success as an R&B singer, but people don't even hear the half of what this woman does with her voice. She's an amazing scatter. If you ever see her live, she's a storyteller. Her voice is absolutely phenomenal, and she's somebody that I also like as a person. So I have her new album, which is very exciting. I've been listening to a lot of Ray Charles. I love Ray Charles. I love Old Soul. And What I Say is one of my favorite songs. Hey, mama, don't you treat me wrong. Come and love you, daddy, all night long, all night. Love it. I guess I'm listening to a lot of things that make me very happy right now. Tell me what I say. Tell me what I say right now. Tell me what I say. Tell me what I say. Yeah.
That was actress Anika Noni Rose telling us what's playing in her ears. To hear our previous conversation with her, just head to npr.org, click on the Programs tab, and go to Tell Me More. And I want to know.